Back at it once again, Monday style, brand new week, June the 23rd, 2025, on Connecticut Today. We talked about previous weekend's U.S. military strikes on Iran's three main nuclear sites with University of New Haven Professor of National Security, Dr. Howard Stouffer, Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill dropped by to chat about those attacks and a couple of controversial vetoes announced earlier in the day by Governor Ned Lamont. Right now, though, we hear from one of our great guests, University of New Haven Professor of National Security, Dr. Howard Stouffer. Of course, previous to that, long career in the U.S. State Department. He's here to talk about what transpired over the weekend. Dr. Stouffer, it's Paul again. Always good to have you. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me again.
So give me your initial thoughts, Dr. Stouffer, when we heard about this on, I guess it was midday to late day on Saturday. What were your thoughts?
Well, I was partially surprised. I didn't know if the president would want to carry out this strike, but he gave every indication in a few days just leading up to the strike that he was prepared to, Iran must surrender. That, you know, we have to use all means to stop a nuclear weapon in their hands. So it became pretty apparent that with the success of the Israeli actions, he wanted to be part of a process that looked very, very successful. And by authorizing the B-2 strikes, he was basically adding to that whole, opportunity to try to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon for a very long time, if not permanently.
Yeah, there's, I guess, Dr. Stouffer, a great deal of debate now. Well, is this permanent? It probably isn't. Did they truck out the amount of material that had been purified? But I'm seeing somebody saying, yeah, either way, it's got to be at least 8 to 10 years. What are your thoughts on that? Just a slowdown here?
Well, I think it's more than a slowdown. I mean, it could be, 2 or 3 years. It could be 5 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say if it would be longer than that. Rebuilding all of those, facilities that were struck by the Israelis and the Americans to enrich uranium would take a very long time and take a lot of money. And I don't think they'll be allowed to start rebuilding it, because as soon as they do, I'm sure the Israelis will strike at it again. So, that rises to the question, well, what happens if there's new leadership in Iran? Mm. And the hope is that, if Khomeini dies one way or another, and a new leader emerges and says, it's time for us to join the community of countries. Mm. We can't be threatening the entire region. No more saying death to America and to Israel. Maybe we can have a new start to everything. I mean, that's very optimistic. I don't expect that to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before, Doctor, with us here, and I've talked to numerous guests about this. It really is a mindset of the leadership, right, of the Iranian people. I've been told by so many experts that Iran's population in particular, because of the Iran-Iraq war for 10 or 12 years, it really is a very young population. And do they want better relations with the West, do you think, the common Iranian in the streets?
I think they do, but the problem now is that these strikes by Israel and the United States have unified most of the people who were opposed to the regime. They're all standing up and saying, we don't like what the United States did. We don't like what Israel's doing. We support the Revolutionary Guards. Mm-hmm. We support the Ayatollah. And so with that kind of momentum going right now, it's very hard to say how people may eventually turn around and say, okay, we have a chance here now to build a different society, because look what this brought us. Total disaster. Billions and billions of dollars spent not only on enriching uranium and trying to get a bomb, yeah, but also supporting Hamas, Hezbollah, Houthis, and the Assad regime in Syria. And all of that has failed for them.
Do you think, Dr. Stouffer, that there is an attempt to block the Straits of Hormuz by Iran and their other actors? Do you think that happens, and what do you think the response would be from the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I don't think it will happen, because most of the oil that Iran sells, it sells to China, because we have put sanctions on any country that will buy Iranian oil. Mm-hmm. And if the Chinese buy it, well, they're already sanctioned, so there's not much downside for the Chinese.
Yeah.
And so blocking the Straits of Hormuz would block 20% of the world's oil, and the number of tankers was seen in the last few days filling up to the maximum.
Yeah.
And the Saudis have been pumping at least 16% more oil in the last three
wow.
or 4 days than they normally do. So they were all, getting ready for maybe a blockage. But if the United States sees that the Iranians are starting to mine the Straits of Hormuz, I'm sure our Navy and our ships, they're not going to let themselves get trapped in the Persian Gulf. They will basically go after any naval activity to start mining the Straits. I don't think Iran wants to do that because they want to get – they have the world on their side in terms of numbers. Mm. And, you know, they want to look like they're the victims here. They don't want to look like the aggressors, even though they are the aggressors,
yeah,
given what they've done all these years. So I don't think they will do that. And their attack in Qatar today – demonstrates that they really want to find an off-ramp to all of this, especially with the United States.
Yeah, and
I would find that surprising.
Yeah, and I'm seeing with the Qatar response to that, and now I'm seeing Dr. Stouffer, I don't know whether you saw this, but there are area countries now criticizing Iran for these attacks here at that U.S. military base in Qatar. So they may see this, maybe yes or no, you tell me, is an opportune time here to maybe say stuff that they didn't feel comfortable saying about Tehran or not?
Yeah, they are. There was criticism from the United Arab Emirates. There was criticism from Kuwait, from Bahrain, from the Saudis, and the Egyptians, all saying that what the Iranians did was a violation of international law. So mm-hmm. You have the Israelis violating international law, as that's being expressed now by China and Russia mm-hmm. and others. And you have all of these, Arab Gulf states and Egypt saying what the Iranians did was wrong. What's interesting, though, is that we have to compare this attack. They told the Qataris in advance it's coming. And so, and the Americans removed almost all their aircraft. There was
yeah.
only one plane on the tarmac at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they said, you know, if this attack is coming, you can knock it down if you want. And it will be like what happened in January of 2020 when Soleimani, the general in the Iranian Guard, that was the head of the guard that Trump authorized at the end of his term to kill that guy.
Yeah.
They only fired one set of rockets into an American base. Nobody got killed. A number of soldiers were injured. That's true, but
yeah.
It didn't lead to deaths. And I think they're doing the same thing again, saying like, okay, we did a strike. We proved that we're manly. You know, we're not to be pushed around. And now we're looking for a way to bring an end to at least the confrontation with the United States.
Do you think, Dr. Stouffer, that in contrast to the way they've dealt with other presidents, Mr. Obama, Mr. Clinton, Mr. Biden, going back to, the Iranian Revolution, the Bushes, whatever, do you think mm-hmm. that the unpredictability, the criticism of Mr. Trump, it plays into his favor when dealing with the Iranian government or not? Are they a little, well, let me just ask you, do they think he's crazy or not?
Well, I think he's unpredictable, and that's
yeah.
what worries them. The other presidents you described were relatively predictable, relatively conservative and cautious. But Donald Trump is not that kind of character. He is somebody that you can't define what he's going to do. And so they're hoping that by just doing this limited strike in Qatar, that'll be the way that the president hasn't said, you know, we're going to go after them now for doing
yeah.
this. Nobody was killed. No damage occurred. Even the spokesman for, the White House and for the State Department said, well, this might be a way for, the Iranians to, stand down now with their demands that they attack the United States further. But there are other reports coming out from lesser notables in Iran saying all bets are off. You know, anybody can fire, any military force can fire on any military, U.S. military that mm-hmm. it wants to do. But I have a feeling the Ayatollah has to approve anything like that because he does not want to lose control of this situation.
If it got, Dr. Stouffer, final question here, if it got to the mm-hmm. point, and we can only hope, where the leadership of Iran says that's it, we're going to be overthrown or what happens, or enough. This is not working out, and they scram. Like, I guess we don't know where the Ayatollah is or whatever, but if the leadership left, would they seek, asylum somewhere? Where would they go? Do we know where he is now? They don't know where he is. How would that set up? Who would take them? Are we talking about Russia, North Korea, the usual, the usual characters here?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought that through very much. But there aren't a lot of places that I don't think the Ayatollah will ever leave Iran.
Uh-huh.
He will not willingly leave, no matter what. I don't think this guy will ever do that. But if he had to find asylum somewhere, Assad went to Russia. Who would,
that's
right.
That's
not a big surprise. The Ayatollah could go to, some country, mm-hmm. probably a country that is an Islamic country, maybe Indonesia, mm-hmm. that's a non-Arab Islamic country, and possibly find himself living there. But I just don't expect that to happen. I think that's highly unlikely. that the Ayatollah would just cut chase and run, you know. And so it's nice to speculate, but, you know, my speculation is nothing more than anybody else's at this point on that issue.
State Department veteran Dr. Howard Stouffer, currently University of New Haven Professor of National Security. Dr. Stouffer, thank you for your interpretation. Always appreciated, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Appreciate it. Dr. Howard Stouffer there spent a long time in the U.S. State Department back in the 80s, so he knows from whence he speaks. Governor Ned Lamont earlier today says, yeah, I'm pro-labor, but no, paying strikers to walk picket lines after 2 weeks, not happening.
I was there with the Pratt workers, and, you know, their strike was all about job security. And I was just at the Paris Air Show, and I saw all the other governors grouped around Pratt & Whitney saying, come to Georgia, you'll find a better work environment than we have, you might have in Connecticut. And I said, that's not true. You want to be in Connecticut. We have a very constructive, best workforce in the world. And I just think the striking workers bill would send the wrong message when it comes to protecting each and every one of those jobs.
And he also vetoed today that housing bill. To talk about that and more, our buddy, our pal from the Connecticut News Junkie and Substack.com, Terry Cowgill. Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
Well, I'm not doing too bad. I actually am feeling pretty good because this is one of the rare summer days where it is hotter in Connecticut than it is in Texas.
So I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I checked it about, I believe it was about 2:30 your time, and it was 97 in Hartford, 89 in San Antonio.
And dry or humid? Dry or humid, 89?
It's pretty humid. Okay. It sometimes it's very dry like the desert here, but right now it's pretty darn humid, but it's not 97. That's for sure.
Yeah. Hopefully that breaks in the next couple of days. Terry, what are your thoughts on this? You know, the governor, by the way, is getting a tongue lashing on the state Senate Democrats Facebook page. But he vetoed, Terry, I know some stuff that you've been following, because he just, for each individual purpose on the bill here, the strikers bill and the housing bill, he just didn't like them. And I find that refreshing. He's not discounting the general ideas of the bills, but he said no.
No, and I think that the lesson here is that Lamont is not an ideologue.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he is, I think at his core, he's a pragmatic individual. His politics lean left, but not very far left.
Yeah.
And the words of Marty Looney and Jason Roja and the others were quite revealing, because it's very frustrating. Do you remember when Lamont first ran for governor? And I think it was 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was best known as the guy who ran against Joe Lieberman in 2006 for the Senate seat.
Like, who is this guy?
He got the nomination, and then Lieberman pulls a fast one and runs as an independent and gets reelected anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But he only really ran, you know, in a passionate opposition to the Iraq War.
Mm.
And everybody thought, because he was so outspoken on that he was a real left winger, he was really one of them, the left. And he's not. I mean, I agree with him that I think this workers' bill that would provide unemployment benefits for striking workers sends precisely the wrong message when you're trying to shore up the workforce. You're trying to attract more businesses into the state.
Yeah.
This sends the wrong message. And then the zoning bill the land use bill.
Yeah.
I agree with him on that too, because I would like to see the towns have more control over how they meet these goals. I think the state has a real interest in having these towns and cities meet goals, because it's an overriding interest because of business concerns and the economy. I would rather put the towns in the driver's seat. I don't like these provisions that say, towns can't have in their zoning code that there has to be a certain number of parking spaces for on-site parking. Well, this should be up to individual towns.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't meet the goal of, 10%, I forget exactly what the percentage is,
yeah.
they don't meet the goals, there will be consequences. I'm all for that. But I think the towns alone should be the ones to decide how they meet these goals and not the state.
So, Terry, look, you and I have been around the same stretch of time. And before I did this, I was sitting in those ridiculous news conferences, trucking around my cassette recorder. That's how old I am.
Sure.
And I don't know, Terry, what do you think? The ideological split between the leaders of the Connecticut Democratic Party, at least on these bills, and their ostensive boss, the titular head of their party, you know, the governor, you know, in a state where he's got anywhere from, depending upon the poll numbers, a 50, 54, 55 to 60% favorability rating. I don't know how accurate that is. So is it the current leadership in Hartford? Are they just not getting it? Why are they so angry, Terry, at a guy who's got a pretty solid approval rating?
Yeah, well, I think they thought that he was, at his core, he was one of them. And to find out that actually he's not really. And but I think, you know, one of the most interesting things to come out of this will be to see, you know, he's Lamont is sort of on the fence as to whether he wants to run for a third term.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think third terms end very well for most governors and mayors in New England and in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Just ask both Cuomo's and George Pataki and Mayor Bloomberg and
yeah.
John Rowland.
Yeah.
Well, they all
yeah.
tried to run for a third term,
yeah.
and it didn't work out very well. But if he does decide to run for a third term, I predict that some Democrat will primary him.
Yeah,
because I think that this is enough of a wedge issue that it could spawn somebody with name recognition who might run against him. I don't know whether they would beat him or not. It would depend probably on the strength candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that will be one of the outcomes of this latest skirmishes. I think there are some progressives who were just fed up.
Yeah, so. And finally, before we go to Iran here, yeah, I think they might do, and Dan Haar, I have Dan on every Wednesday, and he kind of thinks the same thing, too. I had him on, and we talked about this. You know, you may get somebody if for nothing more than to just let the party know, hey, we know you're here. Maybe a primal scream therapy, you know. Yeah, but I don't think they will. But I just think really it would be a release, Terry, for the left side of the party. I think so.
Well, I think so. And really what Lamont is doing is saving them from themselves because this is a real political liability for them
yeah.
going forward. So if Lamont were to come out tomorrow and say, well, I don't really, you know, I don't think I'm going to run for reelection.
Yeah.
You know, he's in his early 70s. He probably figures, well, I did my piece and
yeah.
I'll just go on and do something else. You know, would the Democrats then try to find somebody who's a relative centrist like Lamont?
No.
Carry the banner?
No.
Or will they go for somebody who supports these measures that
mm-hmm.
Lamont vetoed, for example?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really have a good feel for that. I think they would love to have somebody who's more ideologically pure, but maybe there are enough pragmatists to nix that idea.
Maybe. And finally, your national piece, Substack.com, Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. You like millions of us over the weekend, we're all soaking in this American attack on the three main Iranian sites. And boy, if it's ever a slow news day with Mr. Trump, that lasts only about a day or so.
Yeah, he can't stand slow news days. I mean, he wants to dominate every news cycle there
is. And he does.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I looked at this and I thought, well, first of all, it was no surprise because, you know, initially he said, well, I'm going to decide in 2 weeks. And, you know, that that was kind of a ruse.
Yeah.
He was doing a little fake there. But, you know, this didn't surprise me at all. And I think Israel has over the years done a lot of the region's dirty work
mm-hmm.
in terms of taking care of this stuff.
Yeah.
And Israel really softened up Iran with that bombing campaign and also killing several top generals.
Yeah.
And knocking off nine of Iraq's elite nuclear scientists.
Mm.
And so really, by the time the U.S. came in, they had softened, Israel had already softened everything up, and it was a cakewalk. But I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things, and you probably find it amusing too, is this how it has divided MAGA world. Many MAGA people are sick of these forever wars because it's mostly a working class cohort, and their friends and relatives have gone off to die in a lot of these wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're sick of it. And so there is a lot of that. Tulsi Gabbard has said a lot of this stuff, and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important thing to remember is that I think people will eventually come around and they will support Trump. I think most of the MAGA nation will, and they because Trump has a whole lot of sway and power over
there.
And where else are they going to go? They're not.
And
there's nobody else out there.
And they don't want to get primaried either. Coming up in 2026 or 2028, folks, check out Terry's excellent Trump piece, Substack.com. The name of the column, I've always loved this: Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. And read his stuff too at the Connecticut News Junkie. Terry, I'm jealous. Hopefully, you'll be hotter than we will tomorrow. The next couple of days. Take care. Okay.
All righty. Take care. Bye.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it.